You know, propaganda isn't just misinformation. It's a source of your very identity. People are defining themselves as anti-Trump, pro-mask, pro-vaccine people. This vaccine cult that is now, reigning supreme and wreaking untold havoc, and I mean literally untold havoc, on people's lives and bodies, was actually a long time coming, and we have been gradually prepared for it, really for the last several decades. Black people are entitled to their so-called vaccine hesitancy. That is a perfectly rational suspicion on their part of the intentions of a medical establishment that has a long, horrible history of abusing and exploiting those people. One definition of conspiracy theory that I favor is something that, if true, you couldn't handle it. The year 2020 and then the first half of 2021 have comprised a global propaganda spectacle of unprecedented scale and sophistication. To come at this recent history as a student of propaganda is to recognize that many of the narratives we've been serially hit with, were actually calculated when they have seemed to be accidental or organic. You know, the intelligence agencies generally have been, skilled for a very long time at manipulating events in this way. This is a history most educated people don't know, so that it seems outlandish to suggest that we might be living through something similar now. One definition of conspiracy theory that I favor is something that, if true, you couldn't handle it. Okay, that's what a conspiracy theory is. So to suggest that the government, blew JFK's brains out pretty much at high noon in broad daylight, that the government killed King, the government killed Bobby, that the government flew aircraft into the Twin Towers. I mean, these things are unimaginable to many people because they just don't want to go there. So that, an appreciable component of the American electorate or the American people is afflicted with a kind of repression, the way abused children often have trouble thinking of what their parents did to them. They wouldn't do that. They looked after me. They protected us, right? I mean, they have what Lance DeHaven Smith calls in his indispensable history of conspiracy theory in America, he calls it a sentimental view of executive power. There's this idea that the president is kind of our father, and we therefore think it's impossible that he and the agencies he directs, at least nominally, would do something as fiendish as X or Y, right? They just don't want to go there. You know, I've been saying for some time that 2020 had been heading towards us since 1963, okay? Because that era saw the, serial destruction, murder, four figures who all, in different ways, were really genuinely threatening the system with change. The tumult of the 60s, insofar as it represented a move toward a genuinely revolutionary alliance, of the have-nots, that was basically crushed by the assassinations. That Martin Luther King was planning a poor people's march on Washington. Very important, not a black people's march, a poor people's march. So he had taken a turn away from civil rights per se, mainly in the South, toward a larger, more revolutionary political movement. And they put an end to that pretty expeditiously when he was assassinated. But, you know, that extends too in different ways to the Kennedy brothers as well as Malcolm X. I mean, there what that was really, it's not romanticism to say that that was a crucial moment of awakening on the part of many important constituencies, populations, right? And there was a kind of serial devastation of that that energy with all those murders, accompanied by, you know, things like the murder of Fred Hampton in Chicago. He was, you know, organizing Appalachian whites, Hispanic street gangs, and black street gangs along with the Panthers. That's not anything like BLM, okay? That's really forming alliances. That's talking about solidarity. He was 21 years old, right? Well, they had to kill him too. And then in various ways, the FBI and the CIA continued to eat away at, infiltrate, screw up leftist politics, and that kind of, you know, created the world we live in today.
Right, along with Vietnam, which you could say is a direct result of the deaths of the Kennedys and King and Malcolm, all of whom at some point or another, in different ways, were either pulling out troops in the case of Kennedy.
We would expect to withdraw 1,000 men from South Vietnam before the end of the year.
Or were speaking, voicing their opposition in the case of King.
The bombs in Vietnam explode at home. They destroy the dream and possibility for a decent America.
And it's worth noting that in the context of 2020, what happened was not that people were persuaded by the peace protesters. I mean, a lot of people just sort of disliked them. It was that the casualty rate had become too high. Too many Americans had lost people to that war. It was a meat grinder. They were either dead, you know, their loved ones were either dead or, you know, crippled, crazy, you know, blinded, whatever. At a certain point, you can't simply bullshit people out of that kind of experience. And I think it's directly comparable to the toll that these so-called vaccines are taking on people now. You know, there is such a stark divide between the media's depiction of these vaccinations, so-called, and how safe and effective they are, and what we hear from people all around us more and more every day. You know, you see comments on social media, you know, hundreds of them. I mean, people are really being horribly sickened and killed by these injections. And at a certain point, it's going to be impossible to keep a lid on that. Now, that may require a further shock to the system. Okay, now I'm getting ahead of us, right? For some time now, we've been living with this weird split between the daily experience of more and more people on the ground, right? More and more people on the ground, and the sort of hermetic fantasy projected by the media that is supposed to be connected to the real world and has nothing to do with it. So we live one thing, and more we look up at that picture and we can see it bears no relation to what we're living through. None at all. I think something like that happened in the Soviet Union, right? That their propaganda simply could not continue to pacify people. You know, it was just the distance was too great. And something like that is happening now. We've got Bruce Springsteen on his radio show saying, "Mr. President, put on a fucking mask."
"With all respect, sir, show some consideration and care for your countrymen and your country. Put on a fucking mask."
We've got Jane Fonda saying in an interview, "I hate to say it, but COVID was a gift to the left." She says this, right? A gift to the left.
"COVID is God's gift to the left."
Joan Baez paints this beatific portrait of Dr. Fauci. I mean, what is this? This is scary. You know, as far as I'm concerned, this guy might as well be, you know, belting down adrenochrome. I mean, you know, She's got a beatific portrait of the Satanist, right? I mean, might as well be one. And then you got Samuel L. Jackson saying, stay the fuck home.
Stay the fuck at home. The Rona is spreading. This shit is no joke. It's no time to work or roam. The way you can fight it is simple, my friends. Just stay the fuck at home.
His home has about 22 rooms in it, you know? It's easy for him to stay home. He can just jump into a swimming pool. I mean, what is it with these people?
Well, of course, you've already said it. It's Trump derangement syndrome, and it was, you know, positioned as if you go out, if you don't mask up, if you are near other people, you are not only endangering others, you must support Donald Trump.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
I mean, I've seen people with shirts that say vaccinated, not a Republican.
Unbelievable.
You know, so they just made it about that. And they really honestly must believe that they are saving lives, right? And their own life, right? I mean, in other words, they have the full like weight of virtue. You know, they've got the full complement of virtue on their side.
That's right.
And they truly and honestly believe that.
That's right.
And I mean, there's some doubt creeping into some of them at some levels about, you know, the amount and the kind of the mitigation, so-called, or the, you know, the new regulations, or, ooh, maybe vaccine passports are a little weird. I don't know, but maybe they're not. And if, as long as there seems to be a Trump contingent that opposes them and it's associated with Trump, as opposed to people who may or may not like Trump, but just are against these obviously authoritarian measures, they are automatically opposed to anyone who's you know, talking the language of freedom, etc. You know, it's just freedom has become the enemy.
That's right.
Freedom! Freedom! Freedom!
You know, it's the enemy of health, and all that remains is to stay alive, right? I mean, that's the thing. It's this weird Ernst Becker denial of death, clinging to material existence at all costs, even if it means the quality of life of your own children is utterly devastated. Right?
Right, right.
I mean, and that you can't go to church, and you can't go to the theater, and you can't sing, and you can't dance. I mean, which is why, of course, those French protests that you've sent around are so great, where they do the flash mobs and dance. I mean, it reminds me of Emma Goldman's line, right? If I can't dance, you can keep your revolution. But we have to try to put ourselves in the minds of our former friends on the left, right? Who really think they are the champions of science. As Fauci said, I am science, you know, je suis science.
Yeah, right.
It's very dangerous, Chuck, because a lot of what you're seeing as attacks on me, quite frankly, are attacks on science.
You know, we've seen some of the Fauci emails, and it's clear that he doesn't believe what he's saying about masks, even though these emails seem to reveal this incredibly duplicitous character who's changing the levels of herd immunity that we need to reach on a political basis, on the basis of what he thinks is possible. He's admitting to noble lies, and yet that is not discussed in the left media. None of that is known, it seems, to the NPR listener, the New York Times listener. They haven't seen the emails in that light. They're cooing about how they don't reveal any wrongdoing.
BuzzFeed News and The Washington Post both published stories this week that detailed hundreds, if not thousands, of pages of documents that they obtained that were essentially just the contents of Dr. Anthony Fauci's emails from the early days of the pandemic. He had thousands of emails that were just coming in from people throughout various points of his life, whether it was former colleagues, various medical professionals. And you could see Fauci sort of taking time to respond or at least acknowledge that he received so many questions and queries. And he seemed very interested, first and foremost, on providing sound and scientific guidance.
Well, the thing is, John, that they, in the state they're in, they can't think about it at all. I mean, if you say to them, throughout those emails, Fauci is basically convinced that masks don't work. You know, I think three emails he makes this point, and there he's echoing the consensus of all the most rigorous studies. I've had arguments about this on Facebook, you know, which I revisited ill-advisedly. And, you know, I get these, you know, hot-tempered replies from people saying, well, since then he changed his view based on blah. This is just something made up, you know. They cannot bring themselves even to perceive that there's a contradiction there, okay? Now, here are the facts of the matter. I'm just going to go into this as an example. Until early April, Fauci and the CDC very publicly echo the consensus of those studies that masks don't work, okay? They just have a kind of symbolic value. He even says this on 60 Minutes.
People should not be walking around with masks.
You're sure of it, because people are listening really closely to this.
Right now, people should not be walking. There's no reason to be walking around with a mask. When you're in the middle of an outbreak, wearing a mask might make people feel a little bit better, and it might even block a droplet. But it's not providing the perfect protection that people think that it is.
Then in early April, they all flip. And this is just after George Gao, the head of the Chinese CDC, said you got to wear a mask. Okay, there again, China takes the lead. Okay, then later in the fall, Fauci says, well, I was lying because I was afraid there would be a run on PPE in hospitals.
Now, getting back to your first question, which was, what about a month or so, or two or three ago, when people were saying, you don't really need to wear a mask? Well, the reason for that is that we were concerned, the public health community, and many people were saying this, were concerned that it was at a time when personal protective equipment, including the N95 masks and the surgical masks, were in very short supply. And we wanted to make sure that the people, namely the healthcare workers, who are brave enough to put themselves in harm ways to take care of people who you know were infected with the coronavirus and the danger of them getting infected. We did not want them to be without the equipment that they needed. So there was not enthusiasm about going out and everybody buying a mask or getting a mask. We were afraid that that would deter away from the people who really needed it.
Meanwhile, the World Health Organization continues to echo that consensus until early June, okay? In early June, they flip, and they go from saying in countless videos, you know, people very talking very slowly so that the audience understands that masks will not do you any good. And all of a sudden, they're saying you have to wear masks, okay?
Hello. Today, I'd like to talk to you about how to wear a non-medical mask, also known as fabric mask.
Now, there's a BBC report which a woman, you know, a reporter for the BBC is talking about what she's heard from her sources inside the World Health Organization. She said that the official response to her question as to why they changed was that there were subsequent studies that demonstrated that masks work. However, she had a source in the organization who told her off the record that it was really due to political pressure. Okay, now I've just made a kind of complicated point, okay? These two different agencies flipped at two different times in their position on masking. Fauci gives one explanation belatedly. It doesn't say anything about subsequent studies proving that they work. And it differs from what the WHO said, which is then contradicted by somebody else at the WHO. Obviously, it was for political reasons. It had to do with the propaganda narrative. Now, if I tried to explain this to one of the people you're talking about, they would just bristle. You know, they don't want to hear it. They'll come up with something. These people are always making, it's like arguing with a committed communist in the 30s. You know, they'll just come up with some bullshit answer because they don't want to go there. They are completely, you know, propaganda isn't just misinformation. It's a source of your very identity. People are defining themselves as anti-Trump, pro-mask, pro-vaccine people.
Becomes ideology.
It's ideology, right? It is profound. You can't. It's traumatic. Remember what Rachel Maddow said when they changed the rules on masks? She said, "I'm going to have to rewire my brain." She actually said that. A rare moment of honesty from Rachel Maddow. You know,
part of it is that I feel like I'm going to have to rewire myself so that when I see somebody out in the world who's not wearing a mask, I don't instantly think you are a threat or you are selfish or you are a COVID denier and you definitely haven't been vaccinated.
You know, when they started telling people after World War I that the Germans were not the Huns after all, I mean, people had a lot of trouble with that, right? So, I mean, that's an extreme example of a process we all have to go through. We all have to go through. It is actually hard to believe that the most exalted authorities on public health, right? The most exalted government authorities on public health and the best known and most revered philanthropists, you know, whose names are associated with helping to bring, you know, well-being and long lives to the dark continent of Africa. And there's Bill Gates. Is he wearing a pith helmet? I'm not sure, but he's administering an oral vaccine to a little black baby, right? Oh, they're so good. It's hard to believe that and Dr. Fauci, the soft-spoken, earnest Dr. Fauci, it's hard to believe that these people are actually malevolent. I'm speaking from the heart here. I'm not in a classroom now. Every single recommendation that they have made, every single claim that they have made, you know, about remedies, about masks, about vaccines, every single thing that they have not brought up, right, like vitamin D, the importance of vitamin D and so on, every single one of these things is deleterious for people's health. It is the opposite of what a caring government would do. You know, we've heard the question, what would an honest government have done in dealing with the Kennedy assassination? That's a very useful intellectual exercise, because an honest government would have done none of the things that they did in investigating that assassination, right? Well, what would a caring government do? It would have done none of the things that they pushed. It would not, they'd never have recommended lockdowns, right? Which in themselves have killed literally millions of people all around the world, right? So, you know, again, we have to stress the fact that conspiracy theory is something that, if true, you couldn't handle it. And this is the hardest of all to handle.
As your president, I'm announcing tonight a new plan to require more Americans to be vaccinated to combat those blocking public health. Children ages 12 and older who are eligible for a vaccine now, and children ages 11 and under who are not yet eligible. The safest thing for your child 12 and older is to get them vaccinated. They get vaccinated for a lot of things. That's it, get them vaccinated. Parents, please get your teenager vaccinated. Now, if you're a parent of a young child, you're wondering, when will it be the vaccine available for them? I strongly support independent scientific review for vaccine uses for children under 12. My first responsibility as president is to protect the American people and make sure we have enough vaccine for every American, including enough boosters for every American. Even as we execute this plan at home, we need to continue fighting the virus overseas. Continue to be the arsenal of vaccines. There's nothing, not a single thing we're unable to do if we do it together. So let's stay together. God bless you all and all those who continue to serve on the front lines of this pandemic. And may God protect our troops. Get vaccinated.
This vaccine cult that is now reigning supreme and wreaking untold havoc, and I mean literally untold havoc, on people's lives and bodies, was actually a long time coming, and we have been gradually prepared for it, really for the last several decades. Pretty much ever since the Act was passed in 1987, indemnifying the vaccine manufacturers and so on.
The VICA Act, the Vaccine Injury Compensation Act.
Exactly. Right. I mean, roughly sort of since then, we've been increasingly sort of habituated to this view of vaccines as the linchpin of modern health and well-being. I mean, this is completely misleading, right? I mean, what has conquered, you know, seriously incapacitating diseases and epidemics in the past was primarily improvements in sanitation, clean water, improved diet, and things like that. That's the reason why we've grown healthier. And in fact, as we have been subjected to ever more vaccinations over the decades, as our children have been subjected to an ever more excessive vaccine schedule dictated by the CDC, they've actually become less healthy, neurologically more prone to all kinds of terrible conditions, and likelier to die of so-called SIDS. But the implication that all those shots are actually very dangerous for children, right? That they pose a threat, that they don't make us healthier, that's another one of those inferences that people really are not ready to draw. So rather than draw that inference, they will think these people in the white lab coats are really benign. They're really working on ways to make us well. This is sort of fed into this bizarre cultic view of the syringe as our one and only deliverance from all these evils. And it's especially perverse that they should be rolling out a universal vaccine mandate for a disease, you know, that has like a 99.97 survival rate. A disease that you can get over very quickly and easily if you treat it with HCQ or ivermectin early on. I mean, it isn't really as if it's that serious, right? I mean, of the supposed 500,000 people who've been killed by COVID, right? Only 6% are said to have died of COVID alone. The other, you know, 94% have two or more comorbidities, and they're usually quite old. Why do we need a universal vaccination mandate for everybody, including children who have strong natural immunity to the disease, you know? So I can't believe people would have fallen for this. People have been so terrorized by the plague of COVID-19 that they have been desperate for those injections, right? And if you track the consequences of those injections, honestly, if you dig down deep into the vaccine adverse event reporting system, VAERS, if you take the trouble to dig down into the descriptions of how people have died, you find horrifying, graphic descriptions of agonized death. It's nightmarish, and there's a lot of it, because that system only represents maybe less than 1% of the actual events.
As Harvard found in 2010.
Harvard found in 2010. It's exactly right. The same year that Bill Gates gave his TED talk about saving the planet, in which he said passingly that it would be a good idea to lower the global population by 10 to 15% using vaccines and other measures.
Now, the world today has 6.8 billion people. That's headed up to about 9 billion. Now, if we do a really great job on new vaccines, healthcare, reproductive health services, we could lower that by perhaps 10 or 15%.
He's actually been saying that for years. Never quite explains how that works, because it doesn't make any sense how vaccines can, you know.
Well, supposedly because the children will be more likely to survive, therefore parents in third world countries will be less likely to have an overabundance of children.
Yeah, but if they don't survive because of their conditions, then there wouldn't be an overabundance of children. It doesn't make any sense on its face. It's just an excuse for getting needles into the arms of as many Africans as possible. And let's talk about this, okay? Let's talk about Kenya, for example, okay? In Kenya, this was in 2014, a Catholic doctor noticed something funny about a vaccination drive that was suddenly initiated by the WHO, the World Health Organization, which had lately been taken over by Bill Gates. What was funny about it was that they were supposedly immunizing the vaccinees with an anti-tetanus serum, when tetanus is not a problem in Kenya, and they were restricting the injection program to girls and women of childbearing age. That was a little odd. So there was no tetanus risk to males. I mean, there was no tetanus risk at all. The whole thing was completely fishy. So there was a Kenyan Catholic Doctors Association. They got some of the specimens of this vaccine and sent them to labs in South Africa. And they discovered from that examination of the substance that was being used that it was actually an anti-fertility vaccine. You know.
Well, they'd combined tetanus toxoid with human gonadotropin, right?
That's right.
And the combination was creating spontaneous abortions. And, right. And over the five-shot protocol, which was also unusual, it was perhaps creating permanent infertility, or certainly was slated to.
Right.
And this had been a technique developed by an Indian doctor 20 years before.
Well, I did a deep dive into this whole thing and discovered that in Honduras and the Philippines back in the early 90s, again, Catholic doctors noticed something funny about vaccination programs that the Rockefellers were funding. This is all eugenics, okay? This is a history that we ought to learn in high school and college, and yet it's a history that no one knows, right? Because it would sort of upend our conception of the elites in the 20th century, because eugenics was a pseudoscience, you know, heartily embraced by Woodrow Wilson and Oliver Wendell Holmes and H.G. Wells and George Bernard Shaw, W.E.B. Du Bois. They actually believed that it was a good idea and it was possible to get the fit to procreate like rabbits, that means the rich, basically, and the unfit not to procreate. And, you know, there are different levels of severity with which the unfit could be rendered incapable of procreation, but it did entail sterilization laws, right? And there was this infamous Supreme Court case, Buck versus Bell, which focused on a young Appalachian woman who was sterilized against her will on the grounds that she was feeble-minded, which is a term that was often used to justify these sterilizations, you know? She was not feeble-minded, but Oliver Wendell Holmes notoriously penned the majority opinion, and the line that is in the halls of infamy forever is, three generations of imbecile is enough, okay? So they came down in favor of the same sterilization laws that Hitler partly used as a model for his Nuremberg laws. The eugenics movement in this country was lavishly funded by the Rockefellers and the families of Carnegie and Harriman. They funded not only American eugenics researchers, but a number of Germans as well, at least two of whom went on to work in Hitler's government in charge of health programs, which were euthanasia programs. Now, in the 30s, when Hitler came to power, the eugenics press was overjoyed and expressed their gratitude and excitement that here was a head of state who really understood their philosophy. Well, the Holocaust was kind of an embarrassment, right? That footage of the cadaverous figures in the striped pajamas, that was the upshot of Hitler's investment in eugenics. So they had to go underground and rebrand. And they rebranded as the Population Control Movement. So in 1952, the Population Council was formed, and that was also a Rockefeller-funded project.
Still about the same number of babies being born each year. But today, deaths are cut in half or better, especially among children. The old balance is upset. Those who live now instead of dying are added each year to the number of people in the community. Of course, as more and more people are added, their needs increase. New industries are being developed to provide more goods. But whatever is done, it is not enough. But fortunately, this need not happen anymore. Today, things have changed. Modern science has given us a key that makes possible a new kind of personal freedom, family planning.
So it was no longer called eugenics. It had a different name, and it seemed sort of, you know, environmentally friendly. By the time you get to the 60s and the Population Bomb, the bestseller by Paul Ehrlich, who's still with us and still a kind of a militant Malthusian. I mean, they all believe, as Malthus did, that, you know, population growth necessarily results in famine and misery and poverty, so we have to cut the numbers of the poor as radically and ruthlessly as possible. Ehrlich was one who popularized this and gave it a faintly green sheen, you know, that it seemed like a good idea. Now, if you read that book today, it starts out with this sort of horrified description of a trip to New Delhi, Paul Ehrlich and his wife, and he describes this disgusting scene of teeming humanity, you know, where there are Indians all over the place, you know. And I think some conservative outlet noted that, you know, there are parts of Paris that are just as crowded. There's definitely a kind of racist and neo-colonialist tilt to this kind of work.
Yeah, it's a huge challenge that the places where babies will be born are increasingly the toughest places in the world. You know, the number of babies been born has peaked and is going down slightly, but the portion that are born in Africa will go over the course of the century from about 22% today to about 50% by the end of the century.
I don't think Bill Gates wants all those Africans to keep reproducing. And in fact, there's a moment in a report, I think it's on 60 Minutes, where Steve Croft is interviewing Melinda Gates. And she ends up saying, and this is a way to keep from overpopulating the earth.
If you get into this work and you start to save these children, will women just keep overpopulating the world? And thank goodness the converse is absolutely true.
They're not overpopulating the earth. I mean, and if any population is causing environmental destruction, it's extremely rich people like the Gateses, you know, with their many mansions and their private planes.
The billionaire has written a book called How to Avoid Climate Disaster. In it, he confesses to being a quote-unquote imperfect messenger, as he lives in large houses and travels by private jet. A study conducted by Lund University in Sweden showed that in 2017, Gates took 59 flights by private jet, emitting about 1,600 tons of CO2, compared to the global average of fewer than 5 tons per person.
It's also the US military, which is the biggest polluter on the planet, right?
59 million metric tons of greenhouse gases. That's how much the US Defense Department spewed into the atmosphere in 2017 alone. Brown University says the DOD is both the largest oil consumer and institutional polluter in the world. There are entire countries that don't emit as many fumes. Portugal, Finland, and Sweden, to name a few.
No. It's all those teeming masses of colored people and so on, right? In Honduras, in the Philippines, in Kenya. They have to do anything they can to lower the population, right? I think this is key to that whole horrible year last year and what we're going through now as we're being increasingly threatened with forcible vaccination, so-called. Forcible injection with a substance that is known to be extremely dangerous. It's experimental, right? This is a direct violation of the Nuremberg Code, right? So, you know, we have to do everything we can to oppose it. I am actually closely tracking the effect of these vaccines on black people in particular, all right? It's killed a lot of them. It's killed a lot more fairly famous black people than the media has let us see.
Starting right? with Hank Aaron.
Well, starting with Hank Aaron, right. Black people are entitled to their so-called vaccine hesitancy. That is a perfectly rational suspicion on their part of the intentions of a medical establishment that has a long, horrible history of abusing and exploiting those people.
Beyond right? Tuskegee.
Oh, Tuskegee. Everybody says Tuskegee. See, that's the thing about propaganda. Certain moments become iconic, and then you think that the whole history of abuse is just that one thing, okay? Tuskegee is the least of it. It's just the thing we've heard of. But this horrible history, you know, of torture and murder, really, you know, goes back way into early in the 19th century and up into the 70s, when they're still sterilizing black women in certain states, you know, the Mississippi appendectomy.
Mississippi appendectomies became a nickname for unnecessary hysterectomies on black women, largely performed at teaching hospitals as training for medical students. Born and raised in Mississippi, the renowned civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer was one of the most well-known victims of these quote-unquote appendectomies in 1961 when she underwent surgery to remove a tumor from her uterus. And in the South, it wasn't just Mississippi. North Carolina sterilized over 7,600 people between the 1930s and 1970s, 65% of whom were black women. A third of the sterilizations were done on girls under 18, even as young as 9 years old.
So please don't mention Tuskegee. It's much worse than that, okay? The thing is that vaccine hesitancy has now been defined as some kind of syndrome. You know, it's something wrong with you if you're vaccine hesitant. That's like conspiracy theory. It is a way to represent your completely rational, healthy rational suspicions as some kind of neurosis, okay? Black people have that history of abuse in their DNA the way Jews have the Holocaust in their DNA. It's a direct comparison, okay? And I say God bless them for being vaccine hesitant, and I'm also saying that I find it gratifying that vaccination rates in New York City among African Americans are the lowest of all.
Just 60 some odd years ago, I couldn't walk through doors.
Right.
I couldn't eat at a diner because I was unclean.
Right.
I could not drink at a water fountain because I was unclean.
Right.
I couldn't swim in a pool because I was unclean.
Right.
I couldn't travel. We had to create a green book so we can travel safe in this country and travel free just 60 some odd years ago. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? Now here I am at 58 years old standing up and saying we have to fight for it all today. We'll never come back to this again. No one's going to tell me I can't walk through a door. No one's going to tell me I can't eat where I want to eat. But let me tell you something. Any one of you in this audience right now that walks into a restaurant and eat where they say other people are dirty, you're a modern day slave catcher. You are participating in it. Don't eat there. Oh, when people tell me where I'm going to eat, grow your own damn food. Do what we used to do.
People have to be mindful of the possibility, even the likelihood, of a further serious traumatic shock to come. And I think this may sound like it comes out of left field to many people, not to you, that it may involve some kind of seeming alien invasion, right?
They've certainly been pushing it, and many people seem to be aware of that, actually.
Well, indeed. I mean, I think it's always striking when some subject suddenly is everywhere we look, right? CBS News has suddenly been all over UFOs and aliens.
The long-awaited Pentagon report on UFOs has finally been released, and it echoes reporting from 60 Minutes that plenty of unidentified flying objects remain just that, unidentified and mysterious. Here's David Martin.
This strange encounter with an unidentified flying object is one of more than 140 U.S. intelligence cannot explain.
And Obama recently said something about UFOs, and George W. Bush recently said something. Why is this a thing all of a sudden?
When it comes to aliens, there's some things I just can't tell you on air. But what is true, and I'm actually being serious here, is that there are... there's footage and records of objects in the skies that we don't know exactly what they are. We can't explain how they moved, their trajectory.
When you were in office, and I don't know when this happened or if it happened, did you go through the secret files, the UFO documents? Because if I
Maybe.
Was president, that'd be the first thing I did.
You know, it's funny. My daughters asked the very same question.
They did?
Yeah.
Would you be allowed to tell your daughters what was in those files?
No.
You would not?
No.
Now that you're out of office, you can do anything you want, right?
True, yeah. But I'm not telling you.
You're not telling me. You're not telling me what? Are you not telling me that you looked at them?
I'm not telling you nothing.
Why is this a thing all of a sudden, right? Well, what better distraction, what better way to terrify the shit out of people than to mount what looks like an alien invasion. They have tremendous technological abilities. They have an advanced grasp of holography. They could definitely have flying saucers overhead that will actually be government aircraft, the likes of which we haven't seen. There could be light shows in the sky. There could be directed energy attacks on some city or other, right, which they may well wax. Who knows? They have the capability to terrify us in the way that Orson Welles did with his radio adaptation of War of the Worlds, which has now come back as an epics TV special, right?
The roof of Broadcasting Building. I'm speaking from the roof of Broadcasting Building, New York City. The bells you hear are ringing to warn the people to evacuate the city as Martians approach. Our army is wiped out.
Can anyone hear me?
This is what the end of humanity looks like.
You know, I used to scoff the idea of predictive programming. I no longer do. There will be things in the media that then end up coming true, right? I mean, in many ways, 9/11 looked like a lot of disaster movies we've been watching.
Trust me. Everything's gonna be fine.
So we've all seen Independence Day. There are countless movies about hostile alien invasions. That's a projection, you know. That's a projection by the powers that be, because they have devastated continents and killed indigenous peoples and, you know, raped the land forever, right? So naturally, they think in terms of an alien force that will do the same. It'll be a kind of magnified version of themselves, right? What I'm saying is people have got to be prepared, you know, no matter how scared they are at first, to maintain somewhere in their minds the idea that this could be bogus, okay? Because the sooner people tumble to that fact, the better off we'll be. I mean, some few people called the Kennedy assassination as a, you know, charade, that whole narrative, right away. I mean, Vince Solandrio was one. A few people could see that. And there are some few people who knew right away that 9/11 was not as advertised, right? I wasn't one of them. I don't pretend to be. But, you know, this time, I mean, it's possible that what we're living through is a sign of the desperation of those interests to get this all accomplished as soon as possible, right, before the economy completely implodes. I hope that's true. I hope they are desperate, and I hope they fail, and we have to do everything we can to make sure they do. So that means, you know, growing our numbers as much as possible, getting along with each other in opposition to what they're doing. It means bearing in mind the possible necessity of actually going back to something like Samizdat if the internet should become completely unusable.
What do you mean by Samizdat for people who don't know?
Yeah, Samizdat was the Soviet practice, or the practice in Russia under the Soviets, of secret mimeograph centers that would print out the news, the truth, and then surreptitiously distribute the mimeograph copies all over the place. I mean, it was a fairly successful version of what the White Rose tried to do in Berlin under the Nazis. It was just kids who, you know, threw these leaflets all over the place. They ended up all being beheaded by the Nazis. I should add that while we try to form alliances with other American subgroups and so on, we should also be forging alliances with our counterparts abroad, right? Because it is a global threat. We need a global resistance, right? I mean, my experience of organizing is limited to having run the faculty resistance to NYU's hideous real estate expansion plan. So, you know, when it comes to this kind of serious anti-totalitarian organizing, I defer to others.
But how can people educate themselves? What are some of the best places to go?
Well, the best places to go tend to be the ones that have been listed as the most untrustworthy, you know, the ones that are most often defamed, you know, whether it's Global Research, Dell Bigtree's Highwire, Children's Health Defense, their publication, The Defender. there's really a lot of alternative outlets there.
James Corbett.
Definitely James Corbett. The Corbett Report is indispensable. The Last American Vagabond, that's Whitney Webb's outfit. My own news from underground, at markcrispinmiller.com. I mean, we all share each other's work as much as we possibly can. I think it would be a good idea, as soon as we can do it, to create something like a proper news organization that operates online. It's kind of like what I do with my listserv, but they'd be like 10 of me. It would have a budget for a couple of really seasoned investigative reporters, and it would also entail a paper edition on the weekends that would be circulated throughout churches, synagogues, and mosques, okay? I think people have got to get used to reading paper again, you know? And so that when the moment comes when they hit the kill switch, we'll still be able to put stuff out on paper. The Great Reset, which we're being pushed toward, will be, if it succeeds, something like communism for all of us at the ground level. You know, that kind of...
Authoritarian communism.
Authoritarian communism, right? I'm talking about Stalinism or Maoism. So everybody has to say the same thing, and everybody will be equally poor. Everybody will be equally dependent, right? That's at ground level. It's authoritarian communism. And at the higher levels, it will be kind of plutocratic fascism.
The innovations we are seeing today in terms of artificial intelligence, the Internet of Things, cloud computing, advanced robotics, constitute a new phase in human development.
Goldfinger, he's the man with the Midas touch. A spider's touch.
The world will grow more together in the digital age. We are becoming more interdependent. We will have not less, we will have more globalization.
People say sometimes, yes, it's a digital revolution. No, it's not just a digital revolution. It is many other areas. It's brain research, nanotechnology, and I could go on and on. The life sciences and so on. It's a fusion of the physical, the digital, and the biological world. That's really the essence of the fourth industrial revolution.
Aujourd'hui, au bout de ça, on parle de puces qu'on pourra s'implanter. Ce sera quand, ça?
Certainement dans les 10 années à venir. Et d'abord, on va les implanter dans nos vêtements, c'est-à-dire wearables, comme on le dit. Et après, on pourrait s'imaginer qu'on les implante dans nos cerveaux ou dans notre peau. Et à la fin, peut-être il y a une communication directe entre notre cerveau et le monde digital. Ce que nous voyons, c'est une sorte de fusion du monde physique, digital et biologique.
The COVID-19 crisis has shown us that our old systems are not fit anymore for the 21st century. In short, we need a great reset.
It'll be the state and its corporate partners tightly convolved in exactly the way Mussolini imagined they should be, right?
And worldwide.
Worldwide, global. Global. So, look, I still identify as being on the left in as much as that means being anti-war and eager to, you know, strengthen the working class and rein in corporate power and save the planet and all that, okay? But I've learned from this, and my mind is always open. I think I'm not the only one formerly on the left who now understands the crucial importance of freedom, you know, which I used to dismiss as a right-wing thing. I no longer do. I think it was a mistake to take those freedoms for granted, right? That's a precious thing. We can't survive without it, right? I also now appreciate the benefits of national sovereignty. Under a globalist system, you want to live in a country that has its own laws and that protects its own people and is not subject to some one-world system that's founded on the model of China today. I don't want to live in China, and I don't want to live on a planet that is planet China, okay? So I also appreciate the importance of the Second Amendment, especially since I discovered a column that George Orwell wrote in the late 30s, a newspaper column, which it was about the possibility of a Nazi invasion of Britain. And he has a line, I'll probably butcher it, but you know, that gun on the wall of the working man's flat or the, you know, farmer's cottage is a symbol of freedom, he said, okay? Well, George Orwell is somebody I greatly respect, and I think he got it, okay? You know, authoritarian governments disarm their people, right? As China has done, naturally, right? So I think the Second Amendment is as absolute as the first, right? Joe Biden doesn't think the amendments are absolute, right?
No amendment to the Constitution is absolute.
And I now understand the importance of the family, right? I think parents should have the right to determine what kind of medical procedures their children are going to be subjected to. I also understand the importance of some tenets of religion as well. And I'm not as quick to dismiss all that as I used to be, right? And this is someone who wrote a whole book in part on the theocratic Christianism, you know, of some of the interests surrounding George W. Bush. I don't think the danger lies there, you know? I think the danger lies in something entirely different.